The reasons why people flee from their country is increasing every single day.
It was very, very bad. People died in my presence.
It's not easy to raise your children in an environment that is full of violence, full of insecurity, full of ambiguity and loss of hope and desperation.
It's extremely terrifying knowing that, okay, now that this is my new home, I might have to leave again.
More than 70 million people are fleeing war, persecution, and conflict around the world. They are known formally as the forcibly displaced. And those voices you just heard are some of them, refugees who shared their stories on our show in 2018. And that number, 70 million, comes from the latest report from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. It's the highest number on record in 70 years of the agency's operations, and it's double the level recorded 20 years ago. And the numbers are staggering, but they are likely an undercount and don't represent the full scope of the crisis. According to the UN's report, more than two-thirds of all refugees worldwide came from just five countries: Syria, Afghanistan, South Sudan, Myanmar, and Somalia. And as the U.S. deals with its own migrant crisis at our southern border, it's evident that countries around the world are struggling to deal with the millions of people who have no place to call home. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Here with me now to explain this wave of displacement and migration is Nazanin Ash, the International Rescue Committee's Vice President of Global Policy and Advocacy. Nazanin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Monette Zard, an Associate Professor of Forced Migration and Health at Columbia University. Monette, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Monette, let's start with the basics. We hear lots about displacement and migration. What is generally causing people to flee? Is it just violent conflicts? Is it climate change? What is the driving factor here?
Well, the driving factors, for the most part, relate to conflict and human rights violations. And certainly the numbers that we're here discussing today, the over 70 million that have been displaced, as counted by the UNHCR, are directly related to fleeing from conflict, fleeing from persecution, and human rights violations. Having said that, there's no question that climate change is an increasing reality around the world. And we know from some of the research that's being done that climate change can exacerbate conflict. The research shows that as far back as 2007, the link was made to the conflict in Darfur. We know that it is in some ways linked to the conflict in Syria. So it's a complicated mix, but the direct causes people are fleeing from relate to the conflict and human rights violations that they're experiencing in their home countries.
Now, Monette, how have the conflicts themselves intensified over the past few years when it comes to who is facing this type of violence?
I mean, that's an interesting question. Refugees are overwhelmingly composed of women and children. That's always been the case. And more than half of the number of that 70 million that I quoted earlier are, in fact, children. And, you know, I think when we look at the history of conflict, what we are seeing now is a type of conflict which sort of unabashedly targets civilians. Civilians are no longer the sort of collateral damage of conflict. They are the direct and intentional target of the warring factions. And I think that is reflected in the levels of displacement we're seeing today. So whether it's, you know, ISIS sowing terror and directly targeting individual groups within the civilian population, or indeed, you know, the states that are engaged in conflict and their financial backers sort of being able to operate with near impunity when it comes to the infliction of damage on civilian targets, such as civilian homes, but also health facilities. That climate of impunity, I think, has exacerbated what civilians are experiencing and contributed to this escalation in the numbers that we're seeing today.
Nazanin, I'd like to bring you in here because interested to know what is the difference. We hear lots about migration and displacement, but tell us the difference between what you're seeing in terms of internal displacement and external displacement.
So what we know are that of the 70 million that the UN Refugee Agency has identified fleeing violent riots and conflict, approximately 26 million of those are refugees, which means they have sought safety and refuge across a border. Another 3.5 million of those are asylum seekers, which means they have sought safety over a border and are awaiting determination of their need for safety and their status as a refugee. And then the balance, some over 40 million, are internally displaced by violence and conflict, remaining internally within their country's borders.
Nazanin, thinking about this story, you know, journalists are often, we're not supposed to have any emotions or have any feelings. But the truth is, I couldn't get the image of the Syrian child, Aylan Kurdi, who just a few years ago, the image of this child whose body was washed up on the beach in Turkey in 2015, out of my mind. And I thought that that image and that event would absolutely change the international approach to refugees and migrants. Why have we not seen things change after that?
Well, I would say, Tanzina, that you're absolutely right. It did change much of how the world came to understand and view and express their compassion for refugees. You know, for humanitarian organizations, we almost couldn't keep up with the desire of communities around the world to help. And you saw in 2016 a real high point in global responsibility sharing for refugee response. So nations came together at the UN General Assembly that September, and they committed to a 30% increase in humanitarian financing. They committed to a doubling of resettlement slots for refugees. Those are opportunities for refugees to be able to permanently relocate to a third country and rebuild their lives. So wealthy nations committed to a doubling of those resettlement slots. And host nations, who host the vast majority of refugees, 90% of refugees are hosted in low and middle income states, those nations agreed to a range of policy changes that would make it possible for refugees to access legal work and for refugee children to access education. So we did see a tremendous change at the community level, at the national level, at the global level, in how we respond and care and share responsibility for displaced populations. I think what's really remarkable is shortly after that, you know, you had the Paris attacks and you had the elections of 2016. And so what strikes me about, you know, the challenge we face is that nothing has changed about these populations. Aylan Kurdi, those events continue to happen. Children in harm's way, lives in danger, civilians looking for safety. Nothing has changed about the vulnerability of those populations, but what has changed around them are the politics.
We're talking about the displacement of people around the globe with Nazanin Ash of the International Rescue Committee and Monette Zard of Columbia University. This is The Takeaway. Let's talk a little bit about the politics. I think if we expand this population with the understanding that the 70 million still does not include the full total, if you will, of displaced people right now. We're still looking at, for example, the Central American migration that's coming to the United States, what's happening in Colombia, Venezuela, Mexico's dealing with its own influx of migrants, and also different parts of Europe. And what I think we're seeing politically in some of these cases, particularly in the United States, is a very xenophobic almost response to these populations. How would you, Nazanin and Monette, respond to that international response towards displaced people throughout the world? Is it getting worse?
It's getting much worse. What we see is that the U.S. especially is a global leader, and it can lead nations in a race to the top, as it did in 2016, or it can lead nations in a race to the bottom, as it's doing now. So we talked about, you know, the high point of 2016 and the way nations really came together to increase financing, increase resettlement slots. What we see, you know, less than 3 years later, led by the U.S., is a dramatic decline in global leadership for meeting humanitarian obligations. Resettlement slots have dropped by 50% since 2016. Humanitarian financing has flatlined. So, you know, you see these worrying trends of ever increasing numbers of displacement and ever plummeting support for them, especially by wealthy nations. I think it's important to note that, you know, low and middle income countries, those that, you know, neighbor countries experiencing conflict, continue to, you know, with great challenge, accept large numbers of people seeking safety. You know, you mentioned Colombia. They've accepted over 1 million Venezuelan refugees over the last 3 years, and they've done it with, you know, slightly more than 1.5% of U.S. GDP. So, you know, there's the contrast of protection and welcome and providing safety in these countries of first refuge with a real retreat from humanitarian obligations led by the United States.
Monette, your thoughts on that in terms of what political approaches need to be taken to deal with this issue of displacement, given, in some instances, the rise of xenophobic responses to these populations?
Well, I mean, I think we need to proceed on multiple fronts. You know, the reality is, you know, as Nazanin has pointed out, the vast majority of refugees stay in region. And, you know, I'm heartened by, you know, what I see as, you know, the incredible welcome and empathy shown to refugees, you know, around the world in places like Turkey, Jordan, Uganda. And so, you know, perhaps we should be looking to leadership, humanitarian leadership in other spaces around the world, because certainly I think they are showing us what is possible. And the important thing, I think, is to support them in that through, you know, humanitarian aid, through development aid. And we are seeing some mobilization of new actors in this space, like what the World Bank, like the private sector, which is encouraging. But that shouldn't come at the expense of the commitment to also share in, you know, hosting refugees. And you know, regrettably, I think what we've seen in Europe, what we're seeing increasingly in the United States, is the construction of a system that is essentially trying to stop refugees from ever being able to get to the borders of a country such as the United States or any European border where they can lodge a claim for asylum. And, you know, these systems are being constructed in such a way that they're coming at great cost to the refugees who are trying to make that crossing, either across the desert or across the Mediterranean to seek protection and asylum. So humanitarian aid, yes. Also, I think supporting, you know, the institution of asylum is critical. And then political leadership, because the only key to resolving these conflicts is ultimately creating the conditions that will allow the vast majority of refugees to exert their right to return. And most refugees, that is what they want. But that will only come about if there is political leadership, not just in the humanitarian space, but in the, you know, in the realm of resolving some of these conflicts, bringing the warring parties and their backers to the table, and figuring out a way in which sustainable return conditions can be created.
Monette Zard is an associate professor of forced migration and health at Columbia University. And Nazanin Ash is the International Rescue Committee's vice president of global policy and advocacy. Monette, Nazanin, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tanzina.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.